Welcome back to the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan, Ailish Forfar, JD Bunkus, Blake Murphy, and our insider. Brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. Jennifer Botterill, former forward, three-time Olympic gold medalist, current Sportsnet analyst. I saw that you saw my tweet. Are we good?
I don't know. I wasn't sure if I needed to be prepared for some more outfit chirping this morning.
No.
That's okay.
No, it was funny. I was trying to figure out what that licorice or whatever was called for like 45 minutes last night. I'm Googling striped candy, yellow, pink candy, chewy candy. Finally, I guess it's called all sorts licorice. I don't know. I've never eaten one, but yeah, in all good fun. You know, I can't hold a candle to you, a flame to you. I thought about like a little Harvard Dartmouth chirp, but then I looked up at the stats and I'm like, I can't even go there. But all in all, it was wonderful always to see you on the panel, and I had to get a little fun out before we brought you in. But yeah, great night last night for the Leafs. They squeaked out that overtime win, but you know, I think that there's a lot of positives to take away from it. Kipper didn't really agree, but I know that you are a little bit more of a positive. Yeah, you're a little bit more positive, Polly. So what did you like about the Leafs last night?
I think there were good moments. I mean, there was a lot of discussion on these line changes, but I thought the players did a pretty good job of focusing on what they did really well. And if you think about the good things, I mean, the power play was great. They had three beautiful power play goals and some great chemistry and puck movement and confidence with the puck. And I feel like Keith as well, I mean, made some adjustments throughout the game, you know, with the lineups and their offensive zone faceoffs. They're making changes to make the most of those different combinations. So that's good. I mean, they made it entertaining with another 3-1 lead and then, you know, tying it up. But I feel like they still found a way to persist. I mean, other things that I liked, I thought, I mean, Campbell at the end when he made that final save in the shootout, you know, just said, you know what, we've got this. I'm not going to waste my time on shots going in after the rebound and sort of skated off the bench. So I mean, if you want to look at the biggest positive, it has to be that power play. Great puck movement, beautiful goals in the power play. So that has to be the biggest positive for them to take away.
And certainly one of the biggest positives that we're seeing when we're watching Mitch Marner's return is he looks so confident. He's shooting the puck more. He seems like he's really impacted the players he's playing against. Did you see that last night with Tavares, who I think had one of his best games in the last 2 months? Is that a testament to him being alongside Mitch Marner?
Definitely. I mean, Marner, he just has that capacity to make other players around him so much better. And to see how Marner's come back from missing games and just come right in and been as smooth and smart and as controlled and poised with the puck as he always has been. And I thought last night was another great example of making beautiful plays, had a great one-timer on the power play. And, you know, we've seen some of that chemistry between he and Tavares before. And same thing, Tavares was great, looked really confident. He had a great play behind the net on the pass on the power play. So I just feel like, yeah, the two of them have shown some great chemistry. And Marner, I think he does deserve a tremendous amount of credit for the way he plays the game, his vision, and just that he does that. He finds a way to make the others on the ice so much better because he's out there.
You had mentioned earlier about the 3-1 3-1 lead. And it's funny because this time around, it didn't seem to be that impactful because the Leafs controlled the play on 5-on-5, you know, 33-9 in terms of opportunities. Mm-hmm. But there still is that thing that they blew another 3-1 lead. So does it matter as much when you win the game and you can put it in the past? But or how does that psyche work as a player when you're like, uh-oh, here we are again. How do we get here? It's 3-3. We're going into a shootout. Like, what is that like being in that situation?
Something where you can't focus on games in the past, and it's just a bit of a short trend that we've seen with them, but finding a way to still stay focused on your next shift and what's ahead, to not think, oh, we're in this position again, but to refocus, and for each player to just think, well, what's their approach to the next shift? You know, how are they going to be at their best, and to be assertive, to not create this level of second guessing this or creating a level of, if you feel like you're hesitant going out for your next shift or, so I think that's just the thing in terms of the emotional or mental approach is to just look forward and to think, okay, well, let's stay assertive. You still want to be smart, with the puck, with your positioning, but still bringing a level of assertiveness. So you're not sitting back or being concerned about mistakes as opposed to still going after it, and trying to make, you know, smart decisions. So I think the level of assertiveness and staying focused on what you're trying to achieve for the next time that you're on the ice is a really important part, because athletes who are dwelling in the past or, you know, some mistakes that have happened in the past aren't going to serve you very well.
Jennifer, you are, of course, a three-time Olympic gold medalist. We found out this week what the men's Olympic hockey roster is going to look like. We found out last week what the women's Olympic hockey roster is going to look like. Let's start with the men's side. They have sprinkled in four younger future NHL prospects in with some international vets, some guys we haven't seen in a while, some guys we maybe just forgot about entirely. Do you like the decision to sprinkle in guys like Owen Power and McTavish and Levi in with among those vets, both for now and for the program longer term?
Yeah, I do. I really like it. I mean, those are some of the guys that I feel most excited about watching in the tournament, to see, you know, how well they've performed, you know, in the shortened World Juniors and in the games that they did play, or to see their career path and how quickly they're accelerating into international stars. So absolutely, I think for both the short term with Team Canada and the experience that this will give them long term for both professional careers and the chance to represent Canada at many different levels down the road. I think just what an amazing career opportunity where, you know, the country and the hockey world is feeling so drawn to their stories and how well they've performed. And so for them, I mean, what an opportunity to get to the Olympic Games and to have the chance to be surrounded by players with different experiences in the game and to represent Canada. So I think they're just going to thrive to soak it all up. And I believe they're going to be pretty fascinating and pretty exciting to watch throughout the tournament as well.
Definitely agree with you there. They're where my eyes are going first, mm-hmm. for sure. And, you know, we had Shane Doan on yesterday and I tried to get him, I put him on the spot. I tried to get him to tell us if we'd get a Levi start in net, but he deferred to the coaches, unfortunately. But I definitely think guys like Power and McTavish we're going to see some of. Is there anything else you like about how that roster stacks up? Like, obviously, the U.S. has gone much, much younger. Russia will have a lot of guys coming over from the KHL. Canada, they almost feel like they did an in-between thing where, you know, maybe they're the second, third, fourth best team on paper. What do you like about how this team looks overall?
There is a balance. I think that's tremendously important for teams, right? You don't always want to have the same type of player and perhaps even players that have the, you know, the same development path, or you've got players that are in different situations of their careers, play in different spots. And that can be a really powerful tool. If you think about these guys that are, you know, some that are continuing to improve. You've got the experience and the veteran players that are coming in to provide the leadership. You've got Stahl. You have, you know, Josh Hosang, who's faced some adversity and tougher feedback in his career and comes back and is receiving, you know, positive feedback from the organization on how hard he's worked. And then these young stars that have received a lot of attention coming up. So you think about what they can all bring to the table. I think that's could be a really strong variety of experiences that they bring to the team. So I think that's something for them to embrace and to celebrate. And there always can be a little benefit to not always be the favorite, to have that extra motivation for them on knowing what they want to prove and come together. And sometimes when you have these various experiences, that can come and create perhaps the best team dynamic that you can for a special event like this.
Looking at the women's side, Jennifer, it's not a dissimilar situation where they've tried to balance youth and experience, and it's on the decor where the kind of freshness or youth really stands out. If you're a vet on that team or you're the coaching staff, what are some of the challenges you're trying to keep an eye out for with a young defense corps, and how are you trying to make sure that they're ready for a stage this big?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're always, as a coaching staff, certainly with a young D Corps, is just that composure on the big stage. But I've had a number of conversations with the players from the women's team over the last couple of weeks, and they sound really confident. And speaking to Jocelyn LaRocque and Renata Fast, who are your two most experienced players on the blue line, they've been so impressed with how these young players have come in and been relaxed that it doesn't seem like the moment is too big for them. And they talked about, Shelton and Thompson and Erin Ambrose is coming in at 27, but it's also her first Olympic Games, and she's coming in and she's quarterbacking the power play. So I think we've seen a lot of compliments and praise from the Hockey Canada group and the team on these young defensemen that have come in. And I know that for Fast and LaRocque and sort of your first D pairing, they just wanted to lead by example to be sort of that foundation of hard work. But what we've seen from the rest of that group is that they've shown this level of composure and making great decisions with the puck. And I think there's a couple of philosophies with that women's team. They've come in and said team first. You know, it's not about who's getting the credit or who has more experience. And they really, the messaging to all of the, first-year Olympians or players that have just come in was, come in and have an impact. Like, don't feel like you have to play like a rookie or first-year player. Come in and know the impact and believe in the impact that you can have. And I think that was just really well-received by all of the younger players and some of these young defensemen as well. So they seem to be embracing it and feel ready for the moments ahead. And we saw some photos and stuff of them on the plane over there. So mm-hmm. They are all so excited for this opportunity.
Yeah, I saw lots of social posts yesterday. It looks like they're excited. They're on there. They should be there now. I don't know how long the flight is, but it looks like they've landed. And if we're talking about some of the youth on the team, I think it goes without saying that Sarah Filliere is one of those names that is about to, is poised for a breakthrough tournament. She's going to be the youngest player on the roster at 21, but she scored in her national team debut at 18. She's really come into this opportunity and looks like she has no fear. Like, she's playing hard. Mm-hmm. She's fast. She's one of the most athletic players that I've had an opportunity to watch. So other than her aside, because I think that we've been putting giving her the credit that's due for sure. What are some other of these young rookies that you're excited to look forward to and have them have this opportunity to kind of make a name for themselves at the biggest stage in the world?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the roster, I think that they've done a good job. Same thing of balancing these opportunities. I mean, Emily Clark, we'll see how the lines sort of roll out. But, I mean, Emily Clark looks like she may get a potential chance on this sort of the top six, playing potentially on the line with Poulin and Jenner. And then Filliere, their line with Spooner and Daou has really been consistent. That's probably the line that looks like it's going to be, stick together or have the best chance of sticking together because they've just played so well together. But in talking to Filliere, she's also given credit, to these younger players that have come in, and whether it's the defensemen or the forwards, and to embrace those moments. So if you've got Clark on the top line, you've got Filliere on the second line, you've got your top six, forwards, and you've got two younger players. So I think they've been great to see them performing at this stage. And I think they've been really respectful of the experienced players and even to hear their comments about whether it's Spooner or whether it's Poulin who have done such a good job of embracing the mentality of this young talent coming in and having to evolve and to be better. And so whether you're Jenner or Johnston or Poulin and whatever line that you're playing on, it really seems like they've done a great job of taking that team first mentality. And you're seeing, whether it's Sarah Nurse playing on the third or the fourth line, that she's going to just embrace that and know that each role is equally important. So I think just that's a big strength that we've seen for the women's Olympic team in the past. And I think that's really been a big focus for the chemistry of the team. And so I think these young players have learned, but also come into it with this level of confidence. So I think they're in great hands. You probably go through the whole roster, and you've got Turnbull, and you've got Saulnier, who are great personalities who I think want to see the best with some of these young players too.
Oh, well, I can't wait. The Canadian women take the ice less than a week away, Wednesday, February 2nd against Switzerland, which is, I saw the odds yesterday and it is probably the most lopsided betting odds I've ever seen in my life. I think it was minus 33,000 for Canada to beat Switzerland. So looking for a high scoring game. We probably see some of those faces that you just mentioned getting on the score sheet, but nonetheless, very excited to watch the women and the men, over in Beijing. So thanks so much for joining us today, Jennifer, and, your outfit was great. Don't worry. I just thought it was very fun.
Thanks so much. Great to chat with you guys. Thank you.
Me too. Jennifer Botterill, former forward, three-time Olympic gold medalist, current sports analyst, and our insider that was brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com.
How much do you think we can learn about this new Team Canada, like the women's team, in the round robin of this tournament? Because this is always a tough one for me. You just said it. Like, they're minus 3,300, or like, I don't know what the number is, what you saw, but my God, it's just
minus 33,334 to beat Switzerland. I have never seen that. Odd. That's insanity. 33,000.
Like,
if you bet $5, you win 501. Like, you win 1 cent.
I'm surprised you even win 1 cent off of that. Honestly, I kind of expected it to be you bet $5, you just get your $5 back. They win like that. It's not enough money. But yeah, like, what do you look for in games like that, Ailish? Because and maybe this is more of a conversation as we get actually closer and into these games. But like, I don't know how you're supposed to have analysis like that. That's the type of odds where you wouldn't get them. It's like that's a junior B team playing against an NHL team.
Yeah, certainly it's tough to see much, but what I would take from it is special teams opportunities, because I think there'll probably be some penalty kills in that opportunity against a team like Switzerland that might get frustrated, might take some penalties with exhaustion playing against a really strong Canadian team. But so seeing how those things work out and then getting the lines going, like, and Jennifer brought up a good point. Right now there isn't a set lineup. Like, when you've watched the rivalry series or the World Championships, Canada mixes their lines up quite a lot. And the good thing about that is that they have chemistry. All the girls feel confident up and down the lineup. And even someone like she mentioned, Emily Clark. Emily Clark was one of the lower end players in terms of the roster construction. And now she's just been able to skyrocket into the top six. So I think something about the Switzerland matchup, you know, getting the cobwebs out, getting used to being on ice in Beijing, you know, kind of getting the nerves out too for the young kids. I can imagine that you're stepping out there to play your very first Olympic game, a Sarah Fillier who's 21 years old. I think that that's a little bit of like, wow, let me get my feet under me. I can't believe this is happening. Let me get the nerves out, because your next game, I forget who they play second, but obviously, oh, so they play Finland next. Like, that's a completely different game. You need to get all the nerves, all the jet lag, all the tiredness out of you, because your Friday game is probably one of the biggest tests that you'll have other than the U.S. So that's what I look forward to when Canada plays their first game. See what the special teams are like. See what the young guys can do and get that nervousness out, because you hit the ground running right when you play Finland.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. You have, you know, especially since obviously they abbreviated kind of their tune-up schedule with the rivalry series. You know, any other kind of prelim plans that have been booted because of the pandemic situation and not wanting to add additional layers of risk there. So yeah, that Switzerland game is, you know, we talked about this a little bit in the World Juniors when there were some, there was that monster Canada bloat early on. You know, when you don't have, like, that's the time. Like, we talked with Jennifer about that younger decor. It's like, hey, here's some lower leverage minutes to get comfortable in. Here's some, like you said, Ailish, maybe you run a, you know, you get up a couple and you get to run a third power play just so people get some touches in that way. Yeah, but like you said, you don't have, you get one off day and then it's Finland, and it's not like it's the, you know, the easiest group, because you get the U.S. on the 8th as well. So,
I guess we won't be able to put Canada in our wake and rake with minus 33,000 odds, eh?
But the over 6.5 goals could be in play.
The spread is 5.5, which I think is easy to bet. And I think the over 6.5 is easy to bet as well. So those will be opportunities come Wednesday. I'll be throwing those in the wake and rake.
Honest to God, Ailish, if you don't make us a ton of money on Canada women's hockey over this trip, like, like, you know, I'll be very upset.
That will be my beat, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's the line for that first game is so extreme, by the way, that pick any bet on the board. If you add that to the parlay, it does not change the line at all.
Yep. Oh,
yep.
Great.
Yep, 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 yep. That makes sense.
$1 returns 50 if you get that Switzerland upset correctly.
I looked at that, but I would never,
So we talked a little bit to Cabby about the stakes of tonight's NBA slate. To me, there's really nothing from the Warriors game. But other than this, it's both or two of the guys that are in the MVP discussion. I think Steph has fallen off, and it's actually become, once again, a big man race between Embiid and Jokic. But tonight kind of feels like a huge MVP swing game. Because if Embiid goes out there and absolutely kicks ass and does it against Anthony Davis and does it against LeBron James and against a team that Blake outlined as one that is actually pretty decent in terms of like defending the paint, that's the one thing the Lakers do have in spades, right? That's what you get when you bring in a Dwight Howard. You still are able to defend that spot. If they load up a LeBron James defense against Embiid and he still goes like, I'm the most matchup-proof player in the NBA, you're going to have... there's going to be a lot. You're talking about now, it's going to be Shaq talking about the next great big man. Like, these are very, very strong narrative games. And if it's an amazing Embiid game and then kind of a slow Curry one, this actually could be a moment where I think we end up looking back on as a crystallized, hey, this is where the MVP race was really solidified or really swung, blah, 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 blah. And I'm excited to talk about it with David Jacoby, who we have next.
I agree completely. And Embiid, obviously, this has been brewing, right? Like, his numbers are remarkable. And
they're insane.
There have been a handful of games lately where it feels... I've made the joke to Sixers friends and on Twitter, like, their whole season feels like that series against the Raptors where Joel Embiid is, like, plus 80 for the series and you lose the series. Because, like, this is... They especially with Simmons out, but they've also dealt with a ton of backcourt injuries. They just don't have a lot of horses around Embiid. So, yeah, if they come out and win tonight and Embiid, you know, crosses that 33.5 point total, this is a big eyeball opportunity where I do wonder if because the Sixers have been around in that kind of second tier of the East for so long and their core hasn't changed dramatically and the drama around them is about a guy who's not playing, not a guy who is playing, that maybe to a casual audience, it hasn't quite taken hold just how dominant Embiid's been. I think my big thing, and I want to ask Dave Jacoby this after the break, is if you are Philadelphia, you are 9 games over 500 despite no Ben Simmons, despite all these injuries you've had, and Joel Embiid is playing this good. What are you doing waiting on a Ben Simmons trade to the offseason? How many years like this are you going to get out of not just Joel Embiid, but of anyone? Mm-hmm. Make a deal. Support, add some support around there. And hey, the Lakers side of this, LeBron's averaging 29-8-6. If the Lakers can get a few games over 500, he's going to make the claim that he should be in the MVP race too. So he'll be fired up for this one.
I think you are going to get a 1A LeBron performance tonight based on exactly that. LeBron is no dummy when it comes to the narratives and the stories around the league. One of LeBron's real strong suits is that he always really has a pulse of when to pull a narrative with him, right? And like, that's a LeBron James specialty throughout his career. How to make people talk about LeBron James is LeBron James 101. And if he goes out there and, yeah, puts together a triple-double and beats Joel Embiid tonight and has, you know, 30, 12, and 11... I think that's what the conversation is going to be for about a week and a half is who is elevating their team more? Who has a worse team, LeBron or Embiid? You know, like which one of these guys has it tougher? At least they're going to make the case that it's like one team in the East that you got to go through in Milwaukee. I don't know. I just with the Embiid thing, to me, it's becoming more and more obvious considering what the state of the Nets is. Like, this would really be different if the Nets were rolling on all cylinders and were incredible and blah, blah, blah. But like, KD's beat up. Kyrie is still in flux. Now we've got James Harden rumors, which you got to bring up with Jacoby too, of maybe he's not so happy in Brooklyn. Either way, these are Joel Embiid's last 6 games. I just, like, they're so eye-popping. 42 and 14, 38 and 12, 40 and 13, 50 and 12. 32-8, bad game for him. 32-12, like, this is every night stuff with Embiid. And honestly, like, I'm a big proponent of pay attention to things in sports that you might not see again for a while or might not be the most permanent thing. And Embiid at age 27, given his lower body track record and what he's doing right now with the Sixers team, I would suggest to sports fans tonight, put the Canada soccer game on and maybe have Joel Embiid and LeBron on the second screen, and you're going to have yourself a nice night. Let's take a break and let's talk about it with David Jacoby of ESPN. That's next, the Fan Morning Show, J.D. Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I'm J.D. Bunkus, Blake Murphy, Ailish Forfar, and our next guest, one of my favorite shows, David Jacoby, co-host Jalen Jacoby on ESPN. What's up, buddy? How you doing?
What's happening? Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate you guys inviting me back on.
Yeah, always, always, always. So we just went into our last break talking about Embiid and how special this is and how incredible just his numbers are every night. You open the box score if you don't watch the game, or you watch these games and you, like, the guys that are around him and what he's doing right now, it's incredible. He's got this game against LeBron tonight where it's a standalone. The whole world's going to be sort of watching this. Does this feel like Embiid has a big one tonight, and we basically spend, you know, this is now Jalen Jacoby, we're spending the entire show talking about how this guy's going to win the MVP?
Well, the MVP conversation this year is interesting because no one's really come out and taking the true lead, but Embiid is making a great case for himself, and he's playing against LeBron James, who literally makes for a case for himself when he says that he's in one of the best offensive zones of his career. But Embiid has just been dominant. Like, you just cannot stop him. Like, the way he gets his 30 points looks different than the way other people get it, because he'll just get your center in foul trouble, eat your backup center for lunch. He can shoot little fadeaways off 1 foot. He can go past you and dunk on you. He can post you up. He's been amazing this year. And, of course, you just wonder what it would be like if they had something for Ben Simmons or Ben Simmons.
I'm glad you went there, because that's what I wanted to ask you next. Is you're the 76ers. You're looking at this Joel Embiid season. You're 9 games over 500, even though you've had no Ben Simmons and your backcourt has constantly been hurt. We're 2 weeks from the trade deadline here, and, you know, nobody plays media shadow games quite like Daryl Morey. But the reporting out there right now is that Philadelphia is okay to wait until the summer on a Simmons deal. How big a mistake do you think that would be? Like, how many years are you going to get out of not just Embiid because of the injury concern there, or the injury red tape, but you're not going to get many years out of anyone at this level ever. So I don't know. If I'm Morey, I'm feeling a lot more urgency than the reporting around a Simmons deal has led on. Do you feel similarly?
Well, it's interesting. I understand both sides. But one side is you've got this season from a dominant center who seems to be at the peak of their powers, seems to be in the best shape they've ever been in, and is developing new things in their game. And that is certainly a best player on a championship-caliber team, right? Like, you could easily say that about Embiid. So let's put the best people we can around him, take advantage of this window. Windows come and go so quickly in the NBA. We have to get something for Simmons. Let's do it, right? I understand that. But I believe more, what am I going to get back for Simmons? I've got Ben Simmons. I'm a big Ben Simmons fan. A lot of people just sort of like think he can't shoot and sucks. But he's one of the best defenders. He's always top three in all defensive team and defensive player of the year. He's a great transition, unstoppable, great facilitator, blah, blah, blah. So who are you going to get back? Like Sabonis? Who are we really talking about? If it was Dame, I would understand it, but it's not going to be Dame. So, like, yes, I understand the philosophy, but the actual deal, I don't see a traditional dance partner. I don't see a dance partner that gets this done.
It seems like the only dance partners right now are teams that might be willing to give you a couple of rotation pieces who maybe fit better, and they're obviously more than the 0 minutes Ben Simmons is giving you. But yeah, you're not getting, you know, Daryl Morey said himself, kind of, I'm paraphrasing here, but hey, maybe the bar has gone from top 30 player back to top 40 player. I don't know. I look at some of the deals that were kicked around earlier in the process, and who knows exactly what is real and what isn't. But I don't know. I think if you could get anyone, like Daryl Morey's the 5% guy. If you have 5% chance, you should go all in to try to maximize that. And I think they're in that window. So, yeah, I mean, your point makes a lot of sense in terms of, well, they have no leverage right now and there aren't a lot of offers out there. But it does seem like a bit of a wasted opportunity if, you know, this is the group around Embiid once again in the playoffs, and it's a second round exit kind of thing. I'd be disappointed if I were a 76ers fan.
I totally understand. And that's why I started the whole thing by saying, like, I understand both sides. It is an interesting conversation. That's why we're having on Jalen Jacoby today and on this show now, because I get it, but I really need to see an actual deal. You know what I mean? Like, I don't see – I've read a lot of stuff, and I've seen a lot of proposed deals, and I've been on the trade machine. We all have. But I haven't seen something where I said, you know what? That works for both teams. They would both say yes. This makes the 76ers my favorite in the Eastern Conference. I haven't seen that deal yet.
Yeah.
That's fair.
I get there, that logic too of what is the actual deal, what is it. I don't really think that the Ben Simmons moving him away comes back to haunt you in this way. Like, I just, you know, that'd be my one thing I'm afraid of. Oh, did we trade this player too soon? Does it really come back to haunt you? Who, if teams really coveted Ben Simmons, it feels like somebody would have done the Ben Simmons trade by now. Like, when are we going to get to a point where all of a sudden his value changes drastically? That doesn't really feel like something. And do you feel as though he's going to all of a sudden unlock a part of his game and become, you know, one of the best 10, 12, 13 players in the NBA, a title swinger? I don't know. Like, so I guess if I'm Morey, I think I'm more in Blake's side of this too, where I'm thinking I got to make sure I take care of what I do have, which is Embiid. I'm curious, though, do you think that there's actually pressure on Morey here? Like, he didn't make the Kyle Lowry trade last year, and it was a big, big story here in Toronto, obviously, right? Because they weren't willing to go out and get that guy and maximize that roster at the time, and we were talking about, like, draft picks and guys down the lineup. This would be maybe two trade deadlines in a row where you don't try to maximize Embiid. They get bounced in the playoffs in a year where maybe the Nets aren't as dominant. Now are we actually already starting to talk about, like, hey, maybe Daryl Morey actually isn't the guy for this job?
I mean, that's kind of the fun part about this whole league and what we do is because I'm old enough to remember when Coach Bud was going to be fired after game two of the Nets series, you know, and then all of a sudden he wins the championship. And he's holding up the Larry O'Brien trophy. So, yeah, he could be under pressure if things really go super poorly and you know, they get a first-round exit in five games or something like that. But, you know, they could also go on a run and go back to the Eastern Conference Finals. And then he, you know, he lands a big fish in the offseason. And there's always the James Harden connection, which is a very sort of like ESPN-y, let's talk about the superstars sort of thing to talk about. But, you know, James Harden is obviously not happy in Brooklyn right now. He's got a player option for next year. He's got a relationship with Morey. You can see some sort of, like, force his way to the 76ers, maybe a sign-and-trade, maybe the free agency or something. And next thing you know, you've got 1 year where you didn't have Simmons, and the next year you've got James Harden in Embiid.
Yeah, I think a big part of this, too, is exactly what you just touched on, which is how you feel about the Nets. So let me just ask you that. How do you feel about the Nets?
I feel like the Nets are kind of like NFTs. You know what I mean? Like, I'm old. I don't really understand NFTs. It's like, okay, they have value. I get that. You buy them, and then you can trade them, and they're kind of like baseball cards, but they're digital. Okay, fine. I get it. So they have a lot of value. They're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, but I can't touch them or see them. That's how I feel about the Nets. Like, in theory, they're great. In theory, they've got three of the best offensive weapons I've literally ever seen with my eyes, but I've just never seen it on my television screen. That's my problem with the Nets, is if they are all healthy and all three of them are available, even if Kyrie's available just for road games, that's going to be a very difficult team to beat in a seven-game series. When things slow down, it comes a lot of ISO. Like, that'd be a very difficult team, but you have to remember, I just said if everyone's healthy and they're all playing, which we just haven't seen yet. It's been 3 years.
If it was the fifth, right? It's they're very theoretical. I love the way you put that with the NFT thing. On the other side of that same idea in the Eastern Conference is a team that has shown you a ton, but maybe there's not that same level of value, same level of belief. As the Bulls slide down the standings here a little bit with all their injuries, the Cleveland Cavaliers are poised to maybe be a top seed in the Eastern Conference, at least for the next little bit. They're 30-19. They've been absolute killers against the spread. Mobley looks like a cornerstone piece. How impressed with the Cavaliers have you been? And more importantly, is this regular season growth, or do we need to start thinking about them as, hey, a Brooklyn or Milwaukee or Philly really doesn't want to run into them in the first round of the playoffs?
Both. Like, I've been very impressed with this team and this roster and the way that all the pieces have fit. I've always been a big Jared Allen fan. I live in New York, so I've watched him a lot in Brooklyn. And then you've got Mobley, who's just – I mean, Mobley looks like he's been in the league for 7 years. And what Garland has been able to do this year, taking a leap, and Colin Sexton not even being there, and they're, what, 30-19, like you said? Like, they don't have one of their best players, and they're doing all of this. They've been extremely impressive. And Garland and Sexton at one point didn't really make sense to me. Like, I was watching them a couple years ago or even last year, and I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. And now I'm looking at them being like, is this the best backcourt in the league when they're healthy?
I wouldn't go that far, but it's good, man. And Garland's growth has been in ways that make a lot of sense, not just for right now and this team with Sexton out, but I think a lot of his growth has been, hey, this guy's going to fit a little better next to Sexton now. Obviously, we don't know where Sexton's going to go because of his own injury stuff, but Garland has become like a true point guard for this team. Over 8 assists a game. He's top, I think top 5 or top 6 in the league in assists. So yeah, if Sexton wants to be or is, you know, destined to be a bit more of a gunner type of guard, I think they fit together better. I'm glad you said that about Mobley. He had that dunk on Giannis last night, which popped me out of my chair. You know, it might only be Jaren Jackson Jr. who's defending the interior better than Mobley right now. In terms of him and Jared Allen as a duo, there's a lot of flexibility there. There's a lot of versatility. I know you're a guy who's been fond of and is very familiar with Jared Allen. What's the long-term upside with that duo? When you have those two guys and some capable guards, what's the next piece that you're looking for if we're taking a longer-term view with the Cavs?
It's a good question. One thing I do like is just all of their size. You know, they start Allen and Mobley, and they've got Markkanen, who everyone kind of forgets about, and obviously, you know, Kevin Love coming off the bench in Big 3, but what they really need is, we've talked about their 4, we've talked about their 5, we've talked about their 1 and their 2. It seems like they could use like a real wing, because, you know, when you're going through the playoff series, pretty much every team at the top is going to have a wing that can score, and you kind of need someone who can stay in front of them and pressure them on the other end as well.
Okay, so you said you don't see the Ben Simmons trade right now, that you need to hear the names, right? But this is now fake trade season. This is my one of my favorite times of the NBA calendar. Fake trade seasons that will probably never happen, but let's just throw them out there anyways. If you probably have one, so let's get it. Your favorite fake trade, like a fake trade that you're sitting on right now, one of those things, one of those pieces, one of those teams. Do you have a fake trade already for the show? Yeah.
Oh, you came to the right place. How long do I have? Here's one we were kicking around yesterday.
Yeah.
I don't believe that Tatum and Brown should be broken up. I think they're great. But let's just imagine that Jaylen Brown was available, okay? And then you're the Golden State Warriors. And you say, what do you think about Kuminga and how he's developing? What do you think about James Wiseman? He's actually coming back. He's healthy. He just played 10 games. And he looks good. And we'll give you Andrew Wiggins, who's having one of the best seasons of his career. You give us Jaylen Brown. Who says no?
The Celtics. I got to get more.
Let me pitch it. You've got your big man of the future.
Yep.
A big man of the future, number 2 pick. And then you've got your OG Anunoby type, because I know you guys are in Toronto, in Kuminga. So you've got 2 windows now of crops of players, and you've got Wiggins who replaces Jaylen Brown's minutes.
Yeah, here's all I'll say. If I'm trading Jaylen Brown, I need back a sure thing. And Kuminga right now, like, I saw that dunk the other night, I'm like, wow, that is just a level of athleticism. I love guys in the NBA, the League of Freaks, when they're freaks in the League of Freaks. And, like, Kuminga is one of those guys, body-wise, athleticism-wise. He's there. I could see it. I can see the path. But I'm going, are you a sure thing? No. And am I sure that Wiseman is a sure thing? No. And so I can't move Brown. And so that's why I'm saying I can't do this. If there's some other type of, like, you have one other piece there, then we're getting closer. But I just, if I'm Boston, I feel like somebody else can trump this deal if I shop him around.
Well, listen, it's a fake trade, but I kind of like that one. And again, I really would never ever trade. I don't believe in anyone says they want to break up Tatum and Brown. I don't feel anymore, because I think that you've got 2 studs there that if you build around them right, they'll be more successful.
No, the Brown trade I like is, look, Boston could use a little backup point guard help. Jaylen Brown for Goran Dragic, and I don't know, we'll say a second.
Yeah,
that works for me as someone watching the Raptors every night. Man, if they actually break that core up, that duo, and again, I'm with you. I don't think you need to. I think it's people can't find a solution. So that's the solution that they try to pull from it. But man, I think the Celtics would really regret moving on from Jaylen Brown. I'm a huge Jaylen Brown fan. We got a little bit more time with you here. Do you have any other fake trades off the top of your head that have been particularly interesting as you work through them?
I mean, with the health of Dame Lillard, has kind of hurt this one, but I really like the idea of like Daryl Morey getting desperate and saying, and CJ playing really well. I know he's back. He's working his way back. Like CJ, Covington, and like another piece for Ben Simmons. And I say that selfishly because I want Ben Simmons to be alongside Dame. I think that would work great. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the fake trades that I've been pitching in terms of a Simmons thing that I could actually see working for both teams. But CJ having his health issues and, and it would take more than just CJ. But CJ and a couple pieces for Ben is one that I've always wanted to see happen.
See, I love that one. See, now we're talking. Because, again, this gets me back to maximizing Embiid and getting pieces that fit around him. And now I'm getting two shooters around Joel Embiid that if you double, he's going to just be able to now have Seth Curry around him in some lineups. He's going to have CJ McCollum. He's going to have Covington. Like, I don't know. If I'm Morey, you just got to take what is the quote-unquote, like, normal loss in the NBA where you're trading a star piece for pieces around the fringes, but for this particular roster and this particular time ends up being a win. So I actually love that one. David Jacoby, always love when you come on, man. This is always great. Thanks so much for making the time for us, pal.
Appreciate you guys. Come back.
See you, man. That's David Jacoby, co-host of Jaylen Jacoby on ESPN. And yes, fake trade season, we will have a lot of Raptors fake trades.
Yeah, I was going to say, we should have got a Raptors fake trade out of him just so we can fantasize about it for the next couple of weeks.
Here's the problem with the Raptors.
He knows better.
Well, one, it's the most sensitive fan base in the NBA. And so if you make a fake trade, you're going to have people in your mentions for the next month and a half saying that you don't know enough about the Raptors. And two, is that it's really hard to make a trade for them. It's a really tough thing. That's why actually the Jaylen Brown trade was tough for me there, because I go, yo, that was something that we thought wasn't enough for Pascal Siakam in the offseason potentially. And so if it's Jaylen Brown, I don't know if we can end up doing that. Blake has a trade deadline primer that's up on .ca later today, which like will be shared, will be out there. Blake, your trade deadline primer, I don't want to step on it. I don't want to spoil it. But yeah, like, give us a little bit of a preview of what this is going to be, because I want people to actually go read it. Yeah, give us a tease.
So I do this every year, and usually it's like, well, not usually. It's, hey, here are the cap rules that are facing the Raptors. Here are some of the complications. Here's what you're allowed to do. And the allowed to do is obviously the best part of this. And one thing I do toward the end of it that I think is more helpful for people than just like, oh, here's the rules and here's a trade machine and 125% of outgoing salary plus 100K. Well, I went through some examples. So if you trade Goran Dragic, here's his outgoing salary. Here's how much you can take back legally. Here's how much the Raptors could take back and stay below the tax. And I did that for Boucher and Flynn and different combinations of guys. So you can go through that and see, hey, okay, so Jaylen Brown makes this much money. What does that look like? What does that, you know, what does that functionally look like for the Raptors salary-wise? What other assets do they have? What other considerations are there? The Raptors have a trade exception that I think some people forget about sometimes. They're probably too close to the tax to use it right now, but maybe they make a Dragic trade here and then use a trade exception here and it all balances out. So a lot of ways the Raptors could go. The big thing is Dragic's salary over these next 2 weeks this is why he's been on the roster the whole time. And if you've gotten frustrated at him kind of getting paid to chill at home and deal with a personal matter or whatever, these next 2 weeks are why they've done that and why they've been okay with it, because that could be a helpful piece in a lot of different ways.
I like how the personal matter is going to be resolved if he gets traded to a place where he wants to play. You know, like if he gets cut and he's allowed to go play with the Miami Heat, all of a sudden the personal matter is going to be far less personal. Like, come on.
Here's the interesting thing with the Heat. So by rule, if the Raptors buy Dragic out, he can't go re-sign with the Heat. If the Raptors trade him somewhere else and they buy him out.
Yep.
Then he can. So I've concocted a conspiracy theory in my head where like we're going to see the Raptors trade Dragic to the Thunder in some deal. And then the Heat and Thunder are going to have a deal over here that everyone's like, why? What was the point of that? But the Heat send the Thunder a second round pick. And then afterward, the Thunder buy out Dragic so he can go to Miami. And like, it's not against the rules. It's just not in the spirit of the rules. I don't know.
I'm sure Raptors Twitter would love that.
No, yeah, but there's got to be something. There's got to be some. Teams just got smoked with tampering.
They lost a second round pick. Yeah, that's going to be in the 50s.
Yeah. Hey, aren't those picks worth $1 million? Is that some $1 million fines?
They are worth money. Or, you know, you could find a Delano Banton, but sometimes you find a DeJuan Hernandez or David Johnson, you know, like.
Is DeJuan Hernandez still part of the organization?
No, he actually hung a huge line against the 905 the other day. He had like 26 and 10 or something like that. he's playing, I believe, with Westchester.
I was reminded of him during the Miami trip to Amy Otterbird's alma mater because he was from there. I was like, all right, DeJuan. Wonder whatever happened to that guy. He was drafted like a year ago. And it was great because that was the only Raptors pick they had that year. So he ends up getting like way more publicity than a guy who was taken like late first, second round should ever get. And it was, we don't know how good this guy is because he was suspended, right? He was suspended. So he could be anything. He could be good.
And then he spent the next 2 years hurt. So
we got time. What's going on, Eilish?
Oh, I just saw this on Twitter. The Arizona Coyotes are in advanced discussions with Arizona State University to use their arena for the next 3 to 4 years. Woof.
Here's the thing. They won't sell that out. I don't even know what the Arizona Sun Devils, their stadium is for hockey. The Coyotes won't sell it out. Have you seen some of the pictures that are coming out of that place? It's pathetic. It's really pathetic. Just stop doing this, NHL.
No, this can't be right.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
A 5,000-seat arena.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Remember when we put them at the top of our hopeless franchise rankings?
What are you supposed
to? It was right.
Yeah. Imagine they actually built a team during that stretch and they made a cup run and they were in a 5,000-seat
I can't
arena.
Wait to see Austin Matthews at the frats at ASU.
Austin Matthews definitely going to leave for Arizona. Play in front of those 340 fans in the 5,000-person arena. No, that's embarrassing. That's a really embarrassing story to have come out. That's honestly, that's the kind of story that comes out and you go, you got to move the team. It reminds me of, remember when the Florida Panthers, and this is so much worse than this even, but the standard bearer for your franchise is just so irrelevant where they are. Used to be, if you got a car wash in Florida, you could get free Florida Panthers tickets. You went, pardon me. And the season ticket holders were like, you can't do this to us. We actually paid for these. You can't just go get a car wash and 2 seats to our games. This is, and so the league had to step in and say, okay, Florida Panthers, no, stop just giving away the tickets for free. You have to be able to sell them. This is now the standard bearer for worst thing for a franchise is having to play in a 5,000 person arena for the NHL. Time to move. Next stop, Austin Matthews, lily pad or whatever they call them. The fake ice that he grew up playing on. This was great. Fun show today. Subscribe to the podcast. Follow on the socials. JD Bunkus, Eilish Forfar, Blake Murphy. Again, Blake's trade primer for anybody that likes Raptors, likes trade proposals, likes all that stuff. That's up on sportsnet.ca later today. We'll catch you tomorrow. Friday.
It's baby Friday. Tomorrow, Friday.
Friday regular.
And Daniele's Ox Cord.
Yeah. Oh, a good one. Daniele Ox Cord. All right. I'm stoked. All right. We'll see you then.